welcome to Season 3, Episode 14 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Drs. Justin Winzenberg and Stephen Jones. In this podcast, we look to explore truth, beauty, wisdom, and goodness at the intersection of faith and scholarship. Today, we begin our final series focused on Justin's dissertation. In today's episode, we discuss Ephesians 1, 3 through 14 from an imperial critical perspective, and wrestle with the questions of what it may have meant for the original implied audience, as well as what it may mean for us today. But first, here are our highlights, lowlights, and insights for the week.
What are you drinking?
I am drinking cold brew that I made myself here at the office. I got one of those cold brew pitchers, you know, where you just put the grounds in and then let it sit for 12 to 18 hours. And it's been good. It's been really nice. We've had some hot days here, like 100 degree days here, which is really unusual.
I've been hearing about that heat wave in Europe.
Yeah. And we don't have air conditioning hardly anywhere here. And so, you know, on those nice hot days, it's good to have a cup of cold brew here at the office. So how about you? What are you drinking?
Same thing. Yeah. Just some store-bought, you know, in the jug. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I like drinking cold brew in the summer, but we try to not buy it from Dunn Brothers or Starbucks or something because it adds up pretty quick.
Yeah, it does.
You know, you can get one of these jugs, like 48 ounces for $5-6.
Oh, nice. A pre-made cold brew.
Yeah. It's not as good as like Starbucks or Dunn Brothers, but it does the trick.
Yep. What's a highlight been for you this week?
Well, we had a chance. We went up to do some stuff on my in-laws' cabin, and it was nice. I had a chance to bring a book with me, which you'd think for professors in the summertime, oh yeah, we must just be reading books all the time. But it gets away from you, we'll say.
Yeah.
So I think I commented. Oh, go ahead.
So, well, I was just curious, what kind of book, like what genre?
Yeah, I think I commented some episodes ago about how I've been gravitating more towards reading stuff on the Roman Empire and less stuff directly on the New Testament. Mm-hmm. But that's not necessarily good professionally because I got to keep up with the field. So not just because I have to as a professor or for my own, you know, I don't know, what do you call it?
Like professional development or...
Yeah. I mean, it's not just for my own professional development. It's really for the sake of students because you don't want to have your students just learning material that's not up to date.
Man, that's very familiar. That was one of the things I didn't like, you know, when I was doing the doctorate, I felt so like I was just focused on this one part of all the things I was teaching, you know? And so I felt like in those classes I got better, but in everything else I got worse.
Exactly. Yeah. So I thought, well, I still will gravitate towards reading stuff on the Roman Empire, but I better pick up a book on the New Testament. So I got Matthew Tyson's book, Jesus and the Forces of Death, it's called.
It's fascinating.
Subtitle is The Gospel's Portrayal of Ritual and Purity Within First Century Judaism.
Interesting. So
this is a highlight for me because it has been a great read. I highly recommend it for anyone interested in it. It's not an expensive book. But Tyson argues in there basically that the sort of idea that Jesus was against ritual purity is completely misleading. And he tries to contextualize Jesus as somebody who was concerned with ritual impurity. And yet what the trend that he starts to develop in the book is that Jesus is very much so concerned with the system of ritual purity, not in the sense of him diminishing it or thinking that it wasn't worthwhile, but in wanting to ensure that people who came to him could be cleansed ritually.
Like so that it would count? Is that the idea?
Yeah, the idea is that Jesus purifies them. He doesn't say, hey, all this ritual purity system is hoorah. Yeah,
I see.
So he really wants to depict Jesus as fitting firmly within his Jewish context and as a law follower. Not a law breaker, which nobody really says. I shouldn't say nobody, but people don't usually characterize Jesus as a law breaker, but they almost...
I think there's sometimes though where like we take Jesus' words that, you know, I came not to abolish the law, but to fulfill the law as almost like, and therefore it doesn't exist anymore or something like that, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's
like,
that's,
therefore disregard the law.
Yep. Yeah, disregard the law. Yeah, I think that's some of the sentiment that people pick up sometimes from how we talk about Jesus in his Jewish context. So this book's been really, really interesting. I guess the thing that's got me thinking is it's got me thinking some about how Jesus was how he respected the system of ritual purity that he that he was born into, that he may even have been, you know, the originator of, we might say, if we do some Old Testament theology in light of New Testament stuff. While at the same time, there's what the question I have for his book is more related to the ways that Jesus wasn't anti-Jewish, but the ways that Jesus maybe transcended some of the expectations of Judaism during his time. Anyhow, we can talk more about that later, but this is just a fascinating book, so I highly recommend it. Especially because he's got a chapter in here that is fascinating called Jesus and the Walking Dead. And the reason it's a brilliant title, because he talks about the three things that often made people ritually impure in according to Old Testament law. And he talks about skin conditions that we often read as leprosy. Right. But he challenges the idea that it's referring at all to leprosy. And he talks about how the things that made people ritually impure were things that were symbolic of death. And so thus the title, Jesus and the Forces of Death. So Jesus is overcoming the forces of death by basically purifying people of these things that were symbolically linked to signs of death.
Interesting.
Like skin conditions and touching a corpse and things like that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's a thick summary there, folks, and I'm not finished with the book yet, but it's been energizing. I'll tell you, there, like I said, I think a while back there, when I'm reading New Testament stuff, some of it just feels a little like blah to me.
Yeah.
But it's these kinds of works that get you to think differently, that make me go, wow, this is interesting. Yep. I need to be reading up on it. Anyhow, that's a highlight for me. How about for you?
Yeah. So I had a really nice weekend. Jenny and I got away for a night to celebrate our 18th anniversary.
Nice. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. It was really nice. We went to an area that's still in Berlin, but felt very different. There's a lot of water there and boats going by and whatnot. And so just really, pleasant. And then that was Friday night. And then Sunday night I did a prayer retreat, which was the first time that I had done that since I'd been here. And that was also really, just a good time to, I found a place here, also in the city, although very far from where we were celebrating our anniversary, that is kind of like a guest house and has at least a religious background, has a Christian background of some kind. And just quiet place. And then walked around the city. I walked 25 kilometers on Sunday, just kind of going, what is that? Is that about 15 miles, something like that? And just, exploring the city and trying to kind of engage. Yeah, well, I'll come back to this, some of that maybe in some of my other thoughts. But I, along with that, something else I did this weekend is I read as well.
Nice. And what were you reading?
I have gotten into so very different direction than you. I've gotten into, so I read recently, I finished Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and then I just started into Dune, and I'm really enjoying it. I've never read it before.
Yeah, I haven't either.
And I haven't watched the movie, and so far I'm really liking it. I didn't know if I would or not, and I really am. And it's been a long time since I've read for pleasure, and so that's a highlight.
Nice. Yeah, I'm with you. I don't read novels all that often, but it is kind of refreshing sometimes, especially for people with academic inklings, because I think we gravitate towards academic books. You can't be a teacher or a professor or even a former professor, right? And not just gravitate towards reading. It's kind of a requirement in some ways.
Right.
But how refreshing it is to get a book that's unrelated to anything like that and just soak it in.
And I think there's something out of book about reading a book that has no responsibility attached to it. Right?
Yeah.
What's a low light been for you?
Well, it's pretty moderate, but we the house that we moved into has had some plumbing issues over the years, and nothing too severe, but just stuff backs up, and it can be a pain in the butt. And of course, it always seems to happen at like 10:30 at night. and it's like, oh man. And in the past, sometimes I've gotten a tool that helps me to unclog at times. But anyhow, this was one of those situations recently where I couldn't do it myself. So we had to call the plumbers in. But for one, the thing is that when you get specialized folks in that are the only ones who can do that kind of stuff, they're not cheap. So that's part of the bummer is you got to, and they do quick work. I mean, they were in and out of here in 25 minutes, probably.
How about that?
But it's a low light just because it's part of, something that if you told my college self or shortly after my college self that you'd have to deal with, 10:30 at night, you're winding down, your kids are in bed, you're finally, right. And then next thing you know it, you've got water all over the place. So it's,
oh man,
I don't want to be ungrateful here. You know, I'm grateful for our house,
but very familiar. Yeah.
So it's a pretty mild low light, but how about for you? What's a low light?
Low light for me. So in doing the prayer retreat, which was a really good time, one of the things that I realized, like in stopping and just being, I also did a lot of walking, so I didn't just stop and be, but both, right? And just realizing like I didn't realize the extent to which I was carrying sadness. And that's related to a bunch of different things. I stopped and made a list because I was like, what is all this sadness? And some of it is definitely tied to the war. Some of it's tied to the death of a friend, which we had talked about earlier on the podcast. There's, you know, it's like when you go into the kind of work that we're doing, you know, that expectations are always a little bit of a touchy thing, you know, that you always have expectations that aren't met and things that you don't expect that do happen. And so, but even knowing that, that doesn't take away the sadness sometimes of some of those things. And so like, I don't want to paint the picture that we're not happy to be here. We're really glad to be here. And, but it was, I think, important for me to recognize, that actually I had a lot of sadness and that among other things was affecting the way that I was interacting with Jesus too. Cause like, you know, it's like when you hang out with a friend and there's something bothering you and you don't bring that into the moment with your friend, like then it kind of can lead to awkward interactions. And I think, So I think it's a low light in the sense of just like facing the sadness, right?
Yeah, I think I haven't been on like a designated spiritual retreat now in some time, maybe even since my kids were born. But I think one thing I miss about it is that opportunity. There's some times where if you pause and out of life and literally stop what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You have this designated time for some significant extended spiritual reflection. It's only in those times that those kinds of realizations can be made, because otherwise life just is
so constant
and catches up to you. And it's like, you hardly have time to stop and think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's an insight for you?
You know what? I don't know how it's possible that I forgot this, but actually I should have said it was my highlight is that my book came out. Whoops. Oh. Whoops. Anyhow, we don't need to talk more about it because our podcast is designated so much this season to talking about my project, but it was nice. I got the physical copy in my hands. So
that's such a good feeling.
Yeah. Oh, I've only got one right now. So I unfortunately, I haven't got my author's copies quite yet, but apparently they're on their way, I can't even believe it. Anyhow, that's part of the highlight. Not part of the insight. The insight that I was thinking about was related to the book that I was reading. And I was thinking a bit about this. There's so many ways that Jesus feels familiar to some of us. And yet I kind of wonder, because Jesus is so rooted within first century Judaism, whether a lot of the things that Jesus did, the rituals he participated in, would have felt so foreign to many of us because they're so distinctly different sometimes than 21st century Christian practices.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not an antithesis to it, but they would have looked differently. They would have had different assumptions around it. And I even think about this as I've been seeing some folks, you know, there's been a lot recently on some forms of Christian nationalism here in the US that have done very public prayers. And I've seen a few people comment on social media saying things like, you know, what about Jesus when he talks about going and praying in your closet, you know, and basically like, hey, don't be out there, you know, been showy and showing off your prayers publicly. But I think about things like that, like, Jesus certainly prayed publicly, but how much of his prayer life, for lack of better words, would have looked very different than ours because he's more a first century Jewish person than he is a 21st century Christian person.
Right, right. Yeah.
So I don't know. It makes me think a little bit about that. There's something healthy maybe about us experiencing a Jesus who's unfamiliar, because it's a reminder that he transcends the sort of image that we make of him in our heads. Yeah,
I think that's really important. And the reminder that our version of Christianity is not normal. Right. Yeah, but ours is also a contextualized expression. Yeah. 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 That's super interesting.
What's your insight?
I think one of the things that I realized as I was wandering around in my prayer time over the weekend was that I don't feel like I have a clear idea of what the church should look like here. And then there's also kind of along with that, I don't know why I would think that I should know that, but I think there's this, you know, like, so you mentioned in the US, there's this kind of, I don't know, the headlines that I'm seeing here make it sound like there's this really big push toward Christian nationalism in the US. And I know that that's not what the church should look like. I also see the church here, such as it is, you know, and I don't know, I like looking around, I don't know what does Jesus want for people here? Like, what is he inviting them into? I think I can answer that question much more easily on a personal level and maybe on a relational level. But when it comes into the question of like, what does that look like for groups of people or for, I don't know, like the institutional facts of when groups of people know Jesus, you know, church comes out of that, right? Like, I mean, this is stuff I've taught about before, but I think just the recognition that I don't know people here well enough, and I don't know, and I think at the same time, I feel like there's a reference point problem for me. When I look back at the church in the US, I currently am seeing a lot of things that I'm like, I know it shouldn't look like that. There are, of course, things in the US church that are beautiful and wonderful and redemptive and good. I think the image right now, though, that is at least that's, and we've talked about this before, but the image that's reaching me here right now is one where I'm like, yeah, I don't really think that we should emulate that.
You know, for some, I mean, think about all the missional movements though in history that have done quite the opposite of that and just assumed that their home, you know, indigenous church context is easily transferable into another cultural environment. Mm. So to hear you say that is refreshing for me because, I mean, it could feel probably a little bit uncomfortable, because it's a lot easier just to transport what you know from your home culture and just say, oh, we ought to do that here and reproduce it. And I'm thinking even of the film, The Mission, you know, where that takes shape in South America with singing Western hymns and things like that. Right. And it's the easiest thing to do, I think, sometimes for people who are trying to live the gospel of Jesus, but doing it in a cross-cultural environment. But it's refreshing hearing you say that as much as it might feel disorienting, because the idea is, well, I can't just do that. I can't just pull, you know, you don't want to do that. You see unhealthy things, even your own home church context will say, but,
and of course in the church, the historical church context here and the present church context here with things with abuse and other things.
I mean, so, yeah.
Sorry. I've got colleagues out here that are dancing.
What's that?
I've got colleagues out here dancing. Oh, nice. And they're colleagues I don't see very often. anyway, okay, that was unexpected. But the I think he's gonna take a selfie. Yes.
Nice.
I totally lost my train of thought. I think when it comes to something like what, you know, and I'm using air quotes here, what should the church look like here in Berlin? I think that's not something that I need to know. But it's something that I thought I would know. And so the insight maybe is, unlearning something that I thought that I would know. And then also realizing it's really not dependent on me to know that. And maybe that'll change. Maybe a year from now, I'll listen back and think, well, what was I thinking? But I don't know. That's where I'm at right now on that. Yeah.
That's good. No, that's really good.
Bonus content and more at patreon.com/profsandrooms or at profsandrooms.com. We'll be back in a moment with the conversation about Ephesians 1:3-14. So it's been a little while since we've talked about your dissertation, and I'm excited to get
back to it because, I mean, on the one hand, I just find it super interesting. And on the other hand, there are some questions that are unresolved. Like we talked through your method, but we didn't actually talk about what you found. And so in this series here, we're going to talk a little bit about what you found. You were looking at the question of, well, maybe if you want to give it a, a quick summary, I think that might be quick, easier than me.
Sure. Yeah. Overall, in the project, I was exploring to what extent Ephesians might be seen to have challenged Roman imperial ideology. And so, you know, I looked at various aspects of the Roman and the empirical Roman context. I set forth various methods on how I would explore that question. And then by the time I get to the last few substantial chapters, I begin actually just going into Ephesians and starting to explore various passages. I wasn't able to cover all of Ephesians. My book is not a commentary, where in a commentary, you're pretty well expected to address all of the passages in the letter.
Like where you're pretty much going verse by verse by verse, right?
Yep, verse by verse. I just went sort of section by section. In other words, I picked areas in Ephesians that I thought would yield to this particular conversation. Mm-hmm. And then there are other ones that also might yield to the conversation that I just didn't have time to cover.
Right.
So I ended up with 9 passages throughout Ephesians that I used to interact with and to display some of my method.
Yeah. And it's substantial. I read through your chapter 6 today. And so chapter 5, you've created this imperial critical reading based on the methods that you had talked about before, right? Based on an understanding of the Roman imperial context, and then based on an understanding of the implied audience, the implied author, and then speech act theory, right? You're getting into actually creating this reading, which probably the easiest way to think about it would be like these readings are sort of like sections from a commentary. If you had written a whole imperial critical commentary on Ephesians.
Yeah, that's kind of it. And this is actually what it is. What I wanted to do is I wanted to evaluate Ephesians, but my PhD advisor said, well, that's going to be difficult when there are several sections in Ephesians that haven't had imperial critical readings offered. So what are you going to do? So what he suggested is that I first establish a provisional imperial critical reading.
And this is really important because this is not like, it's not like you're necessarily setting out to say, this is 100% what I think, right? This is more of using the approaches that I've talked about. This is how it might look.
Yeah. Yeah. What I had to do is either develop how I would anticipate imperial critical interpreters might approach the passage or use existing interpretations. So where Ephesians had been largely ignored in imperial critical discussions, there had been some that had been published. So I do utilize what has been published in some of these areas to say, well, this person do approach Ephesians, you know, this particular passage in an imperial critical way. And here's what they conclude. And then I will add some my own ways that it could potentially be read. And then I leave it open-ended. That's chapter 5. It's an open-ended, all right, here's some provisional readings. Mm-hmm. Chapter 6 is me going back to them and then evaluating it through the lenses of my method.
Okay.
Sometimes of which I affirm those readings and other times I nuance them and other times I challenge them. And that's the approach I sort of had to take. It wasn't ideal. It should have probably been one chapter, but my advisor wouldn't let me have a 90-page chapter.
I don't know how it could have been one chapter because I only read chapter 6 and it was a lot to get through. And I mean, I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, there's just so much there that you're having to wrestle with and trying to say, okay, here's what other people have done and here's where maybe that was good and here's maybe that wasn't good. And
yeah.
And then also I think one of the things, and we talked about this early on, and if any listeners haven't heard this discussion yet, it's worth going back and listening to, but we're talking about how there's a couple of different approaches to the date of Ephesians as well as authorship of Ephesians. And you deal with all of that. And so we don't need to get into that now, but it does definitely complicate what you're doing because in many cases, I think maybe in every case you're saying, here's what it would look like if it's an early date, here's what it would look like if it wasn't an early date. And then implied in that is the question of if it's Paul or what's the word, Deuteropolitan or?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what you're getting into there is thick in the weeds for maybe some of our listeners, but that's kind of the nature of a PhD dissertation, is that you have to engage some of these questions that nuance the conversation in ways that haven't been nuanced. Whereas for readers who maybe already assume that Ephesians was written by Paul or maybe not written by Paul, that conversation might feel a little burdensome or cumbersome. Like, why are we doing this?
I almost felt like you could have I would have been impractical, but it would have been super interesting to almost write chapter 6 as two chapters, one which assumed, you know, Pauline authorship with the early date, and then one that was, it's not quite right to call a non-Pauline authorship, right? It'd be more of a...
It depends. Non-Pauline in the sense of that it's usually viewed as the empirical person, Paul, wasn't the one responsible for writing the letter, but a sort of Pauline school, which could be disciples of Paul, could be seen to have written it, and or just some other empirical person, or somebody is writing from the Pauline vantage point. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's where it gets complicated. Like, you could have a non-Pauline author who is not writing from their perspective, but trying to project what they knew of Paul.
Mm-hmm. As well as Paul's context, right? So this is where the implied context gets really interesting. So that's where it gets
messy. This is where, for our listeners who are interested in academic conversations, that might really intrigue them. For others, it might feel a little weighty. But
it definitely complicates the reading because you kind of have to hold these two things in mind going through.
One thing I think I had to be careful of is if I'm setting up a provisional reading and then evaluating that reading, it could be a sort of lob situation. What's the technical term for this? But I could be establishing readings that I then either intend to just inherently affirm or inherently attack.
Sure, which would be like a straw man on that side, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that's the danger, is creating a straw man where no one would really articulate these readings, but I'm just setting it up to prove my point. That really wasn't the goal. To be fair, more imperial critical readings of Ephesians have emerged even since I finished my dissertation. Mm-hmm. And so I think ideally I would go back and redo chapter 5 some. I'm never going to do this.
Ideally is sort of a strange word for that.
Yeah. And then I wouldn't maybe engage these sort of speculative imperial critical readings that I had to do to some extent, but I would mostly engage the already developed readings, which I certainly have some of, but this is just a reminder to our listeners. It's not really about the project per se, as much as to say a goal, I think, in being a scholar of New Testament studies is to try to be as fair as possible to the readings, and to try to not just establish something that is easily provable or disprovable to make look good. This is why I think it's a difference between working on something like this and maybe making a social media post, because in social media posts, it's easy in some ways to throw up a lob where your points always look valid because of course the things you're engaging are the things you intend to attack.
Right.
And so I think you always have to be cautious of, if you want to be fair to the data and you want to be fair to your approach, then be cautious of setting up the straw man. And hopefully I think people who read my work will see that I didn't do that, but I could see it being an accusation.
Sure. And that is part of the point of the, your advisor and your committee, right? Is to catch that also, if you've done that.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yep.
Well, I would be interested to jump in here. Ephesians 1. So chapter 1 verses 3 through 14, is it worth reading it?
I think it's quite long. In fact, our listeners may already know this, but they may not. It's notoriously long because it's one sentence in Greek. but what I will say, I think I can invoke what it says, and hopefully that'll be a reminder to our listeners. Otherwise, they're welcome to read it themselves.
Sure.
But this passage is sort of, it is one of those beautiful intro passages, I'll say, because I think a lot of readers of the New Testament find this one to be a passage that they naturally gravitate towards because of some of the bold claims it's making. So this is the passage where it begins with blessing God for having blessed us in the heavenly realms in the Messiah. So it talks about all these benefits that have been given to God's people. But in the case of Ephesians, it's been given to God's people in the Messiah, or as a lot of our listeners are probably used to seeing in their New Testaments, in Christ. Mm-hmm. And I say in the Messiah as a reminder, because Christos, the word that's used there, is often best, I think, translated Messiah, rather than thinking of it as like Jesus' second name. So all these great benefits are expressed in this first part of Ephesians, things like having been chosen to be holy and blameless, having been adopted to sonship, having been redeemed and forgiven, and being the praise of his glory, and having received an inheritance. So this is often,
also the passage that talks about having been sealed for the day of redemption, right, by the Holy Spirit, this deposit of the Holy Spirit.
So I think in a lot of Bible studies, this passage has been pointed out as like, for lack of better terms, people might call it, a Christian's identity in the Messiah or in Jesus. So right. who are you, or who are, you know, the person of faith, who are they in light of what Jesus has done?
And of course, one of the main wrestling points that we'd often do in this passage would be related to the word predestined, right? Like what is predestination? Yeah. And like that is where our focus tends to go if we're having some kind of a polemical conversation here.
Yep. Yeah. And having been chosen and predestined, which becomes some of the controversy. But I think that actually this is a good place to go that could illustrate some of the approaches I've taken to reading this passage. And that in scholarly circles, the passage is often understood to invoke these deeply rich Jewish motifs, we'll say.
And this is part of where identifying Christos as the Messiah is important then.
Yeah. Yep. So in other words, all these benefits that Israel as a people have received, in fact, all the things that I just mentioned that are invoked in Ephesians 1:3-14 were things that were seen to be a part of Israel's identity in the Hebrew Bible or in the Old Testament. And so there raises this interesting question. So it begins with re-invoking these blessings that are given to the people of Israel, but then now saying that these are found in the Messiah. And of course, in Ephesians, the Messiah is Jesus.
And where, what would be an example of where we'd see that in the Old Testament?
Yeah. Okay. Blessings. I mean, all of these things that I invoked,
the Deuteronomy 28, like would that be the sort of place?
Well, sure. Or the Abrahamic covenant, right? Mm-hmm. That you'll be blessed in order to bless others. Having been chosen. And this is an interesting point. You mentioned that the chosen and predestined bit is some of the stuff that is the hang up for a lot of people reading this passage because it feels uncomfortable. But ironically, when we read that through a sort of Reformation lens. And what I mean by that is the conversations about predestination that are happening in the Reformation era and afterward, which is predominantly about, does God choose and select some people for salvation?
Right.
And some people for damnation. That in some ways, what's the word I'm looking for? I want to say conceal. That's not the right word.
Obfuscates or?
Well, that's a good word, but that's maybe it obscures. Misses it. Yes, that's it. That's it. That's perfectly it. It obscures some of the fact that this imagery isn't really stemming from that conversation.
Oh,
it's stemming
sure.
from places in the Old Testament where those honorific privileges were given to Israel. So
man,
chosen.
Let's just pause there for a second, because I think that that's so important how, like, I can't help but read that Reformation, right? Like thinking, especially of Calvin, right? Those kinds of, I can't help but read this passage without that frame in mind, but the original readers would not have had that frame in mind. They would have had the Old Testament being the primary theological framework, right? That they would likely have been approaching this. Plus, of course, whatever they've picked up from the Roman imperial context and other things that you deal with. But that is so important when we think about the hermeneutics of what is this passage saying? What was it intended to say? Which of course, you know, is so much of what you're getting at anyway, but that's super interesting how, for me, just catching myself here, I'm bringing something to this passage that probably, I don't know, like there's a certainty that the specific conversation that I'm bringing to this passage was not there for the original readers.
Yeah. And that's important. And you think about what it meant for Israel to be chosen. Mm. It didn't mean that God was hand selecting either Israel as a people or even Israel, individual Israelites for salvation, and then hand selecting others for damnation. Mm. The chosenness was really about their being a model people to the rest of the world of what it meant to know the one true God. So I think it's important to remember that, because this now is going to raise questions about Ephesians, because there is this theological view known as supersessionism. It's a big word.
That is a big word.
But what it is, it's a concern that's been developed, especially after World War II, that is hesitant to read these passages in light of Jesus the Messiah in some ways, because it could indicate that the church takes over the role of Israel and that God is somehow given up on the people of Israel.
Of course.
So supersessionist is this idea that the church supplants Israel as a people of God. Just to be clear, go ahead.
Well, Romans 9, is a big question with that.
Yes. No, Romans 9 through 11 is at the core of a lot of that conversation. But I want to start by saying, without getting too thick in the weeds here, that what I'm initially suggesting about these blessings and benefits having been given to the people of Israel, but now being seen to arrive in the Messiah, is not necessarily, it doesn't have to be read through this sort of supersessionist lens to say, see, God has given up on Israel as his people, and then maybe supplanted the people of Israel with the church. But it does raise questions here. In fact, there's a whole work written by a scholar named Lionel Windsor, where he engages the question of the extent that Ephesians is supersessionist. In other words, all of this language could be seen to be problematic, perhaps replacing Israel with the church. And Windsor's work engages that conversation in more detail. So just to say, if you're a listener and you're like, ooh, this sounds a little bit like Windsorberg's proposing this, I'm not necessarily saying that. But I think the important conversation for imperial critical discussions is, if all of these benefits that were granted to Israel are being invoked in this passage, then doesn't that make it sort of irrelevant for understanding it in a Roman imperial context? Because this imagery is coming from Judaism. This imagery is not coming from the Roman Empire.
So if you're inclined to think that Ephesians has nothing to do with the Roman Empire, then you would just look at this and you'd say, look, this is just about the relationship between the Old Testament and the New Testament, the relationship between the people of God in both situations. You know, it's extending those Old Testament blessings into the New Testament people of the church.
Yep. That's right.
And then the question of why would you even see anything about the Roman imperial context here? Look, I'm looking at the words, there's nothing there.
No, that's absolutely right. What you're saying there, that's one of the hesitations of even exploring whether this is challenging the Roman Empire, saying, no, all of this imagery is rooted within Judaism. There is no conversation in these words when it comes to exploring ideas about the Roman Empire or their ideology. So I can start to articulate for you all how this could actually be brought into conversation with it. This is where I go on my work. So should I just start offering a few possibilities for how this could be interpreted in an imperial critical sense?
Yeah, I think so. I think that maybe before you do though, so one of the things that comes up in several of your passages that you're looking at is this idea that X equals Y in C. Could you maybe explain what that is? And maybe that'll help us as we get into this section here.
Yeah, that's the extent of my knowledge of math. It sounds like an algebra equation, but it's not. It's basically all it is this, is it's using one form of speech act theory that says that certain speech acts can count as a different speech act, or I would say this, certain locutions can count as a different speech act in a given context.
So a locution can be a different illocution or a different perlocution depending on the context. Is that right?
Yeah. So let's go back to the classic example that I always use, but we've used it in the podcast before, and that is the ice is thin over there. If you're in Northern California and you see somebody walking out and there's ice somewhere, and you see somebody walking out on ice and the person immediately yells, the ice is thin over there. The ice is thin over there is the locution. The speech act could be a warning. The context would be Northern California. Transfer that into a different environment. Transfer that into a lake in Northern Minnesota. The same exact locution.
So X.
Right? The ice is thin over there. Right. X might not count as a warning. It might count as a directive, right? And the directive would be, that's where you should drill. in the ice
to go fishing
because the ice is relatively thin over there compared to it being 4 feet thick, you know, somewhere else. So the context could change the speech act.
Yeah. So sea is actually where the variation is, right? The context. And then that changes what y is. So instead of x equaling x, x equals y and c.
Yeah, or if you're at a softball game and your wife and kids are there and you're sitting in the dugout hanging out with the boys and your wife yells over to you and says, you know, hey, I could really use some help over here. And you're like, I can't, I'm about to bat. And then she marches off with the kids and stomps off, you know, in a fury. And one of the guys on the bench says, wow, the ice is thin over there. You see, it's a very different speech act. Or he's on thin ice, right? So what you're invoking here is the idea that that I invoke, which is that speech acts and actually locutions can only really be discerned in context. So this is going to raise questions about all of these passages in Ephesians as to, depending on how we assess the context, whether it's maybe mid first century or late first century, whether Paul wrote it or not, it might actually change the meaning of these speech acts as it relates to its Roman imperial environment.
Okay, so then in this particular context, we have this Messiah-focused passage, right? Talking about bringing these benefits of being part of the people of God into the New Testament reality. So what are we looking at then where you're saying, well, maybe X doesn't equal only X, you know, or what's happening here?
What's important is there's one other interpretive approach that's important for this passage. And that is there has been a book published recently on whether Ephesians invokes the concept of a new Exodus. For our listeners, what that is it's when you read the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, there are places throughout the prophetic texts where there was an anticipation that someday God would bring about another Exodus for Israel, like the first one. And it could be an Exodus from foreign powers, right? Remember how the first Exodus, of course, was releasing Israel from slavery in Egypt. And so there's this discussion of the prophets about God doing a new Exodus for Israel. What this most recent work by Richard Cozart has done is to show that Ephesians may well invoke that concept and believe that the new Exodus promised in the prophets was actually brought about by Jesus. And this passage in particular is seen, this Ephesians 1, 3 through 14, is seen to indicate that sort of subtly.
Interesting. So it's not the riding in on a white horse and overthrowing the Roman government that maybe some people were expecting of the Messiah, but there's something else that happened.
Yeah. So this could be one way of approaching it. If all these blessings and benefits are seen to arrive in the Messiah, could this be also indicating that this means that the great anticipated new Exodus has arrived? But if so, wouldn't that be seen as having arrived spiritually in Jesus? And if that's true, then this probably has nothing to say about Roman imperial authorities, because the new Exodus isn't a liberation from foreign, you know, oppressive powers. The new Exodus would be seen to be a liberation from, say, like spiritual, you know, oppression or something.
Which would leave Jesus' followers in the first couple of centuries asking the question, perhaps, you know, does this new Exodus have nothing to say about the Roman oppression that I find myself under?
Yeah. So if we were inclined to engage this with the question of empire, somebody could say, yes, this invokes all of that imagery from the Old Testament. Yes, Jesus is seen to be the arrival of the new Exodus. However, that says nothing about the Roman Empire, because it's all spiritually and it really is irrelevant then to the question of empire. What I then do in this conversation is I take it up a level and I say, well, but if the arrival of the new Exodus is in fact in view here, then isn't it making an eschatological claim? And oh boy, what's that, right? We've talked eschatology before.
Which I know one of the ways that you've described eschatology has to do with the arrival of the pinnacle of history, right?
Yeah, that's the way I like to usually talk about it. And there's problems with that as well, but I think I like to simplify it there because it expands it beyond some of the ways we usually understand it. Yeah, so Ephesians then would envision that the arrival of the pinnacle of history has arrived already in part in the Messiah. And then what I ask is, okay, what would that claim have to say in light of its Roman imperial context, where alternative claims about the arrival of the pinnacle of history were being made.
Right.
So you see, we're going up several levels. I don't have to reimagine that the blessings or that the forgiveness or redemption expressed in this passage are referring to Roman imperial ideology. We can say, yes, this is all Jewish imagery. This is all imagery invoking this potent theology of the new Exodus. But what implications might that have for alternative claims that are being made about the arrival of the pinnacle of history at the time within which this was being written?
So you're not trying to look at something like, for example, he made known to us the mystery of his will according to his good pleasure. You're not trying to look at that and say, well, so clearly his good will is, you know, that the Romans be overthrown or something like that. Like it's not at that locutionary level where you're saying, here's what his goodwill means. You're going up a level and saying, what is this passage doing? Is that right?
Yeah. It's a clash of narratives. It's a clash of ideologies. It's a clash of eschatologies. What we have to then begin to ask though is Roman imperial eschatology the most plausible sort of backdrop, or might we say conversation partner that this passage may be invoking?
Or even an, I want to say like an anti, it's not an anti-eschatology, but like an opposing or alternative counter-eschatology. Yeah. Yeah. So if this passage is saying this new Exodus has arrived, which is a huge claim, right? That's not a little claim. That's like, this is a huge claim, right? The whole Old Testament has been pointing toward this, right? This whole movement over the last couple thousand of years has been moving toward this. And then here's this author in Ephesians saying, yes, it's happened. Then the question is, the question you're asking is in the context of the readers, who else is saying the pinnacle of history has arrived?
Yeah. And one expression of that is the sort of the idea coming from Roman imperial ideology that the golden age has arrived. And one distinct difference in the Roman expression of that, we did talk about this, I think several episodes ago now in the podcast, is the idea that the Roman sort of cyclical view of history isn't linear, like it's often thought of in Christian circles, whether that's the case in all interpretations of Christian theology, of course, is up for grabs. But there was something important about thinking that when Augustus arrived on the scene and did all these things, that it provided this sort of unprecedented era of flourishing, of wealth, and of prosperity to the Roman Empire, and that it was seen as this sort of pinnacle moment for Roman history. We see it expressed in various inscriptions and whatnot. And so what I do raise here is one point to say Roman imperial eschatology could be one of the eschatologies that is sort of implicitly challenged in depicting Jesus as bringing about the arrival of the new Exodus. But we can also say that there are other eschatologies floating around that aren't particular to Roman imperial eschatology that could be in view here as well. So that's where we want to say it could be read as anti-imperial, but we have to acknowledge that there are other potential conversation partners that are existing at the time that could also be challenged.
This would have to do like with some of the temple worship for some of the different gods or goddesses. Is that right?
Yep.
Like Artemis, I think you mentioned.
Exactly. Yep, exactly. And we need to then begin to ask is what's the speech act here? Is the speech act the declaration of the new Exodus's arrival, or might the speech act be intended to convince the implied audience that it has arrived by no other means?
In which case, any alternative claim is a potential target? Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Potentially. Yeah. So that's one area. This is kind of one of the ways that I engage the conversations. And again, it gets a little thick in the weeds, but what's important about it is to start to wonder in what ways did the speech acts here of the New Testament have much wider conversations in some ways that it's participating in than what is just found on the sort of locutionary level of the text words. Not all of this is certain. You know, we're speculating, or we're working with probabilities, we're working with possibilities. But what's important about this now, just to go one step further, is for our listeners who are interested in reading the Bible as Christian scripture, it raises important questions about how the words of scripture then will do the same within our own contemporary environments.
Interesting.
So in what ways could the scriptures points about who Jesus is and who human beings are and what's wrong with the world and where the world's heading and what's the solution? How could those also in some ways be challenging, implicitly challenging, certainly not challenging, meaning that the author intended to challenge these things because they couldn't have had it in directly, mind when they're writing. Yeah, not directly, but what ways could it implicitly challenge contemporary eschatologies that are floating around in our world?
So I want to ask you a follow-up question to that, but first, would it be okay if I read a little excerpt from your dissertation here?
Sure. Yep.
Because I think that this maybe helps bring it all into one place, which of course is part of what you're working on doing is exactly that. So these are your words then. As my work with the implied readers of the epistle has shown, there are good reasons to view them, that's the implied readers, as gentle God-fearers located in Asia Minor. If so, such an audience was aware of the eschatological claims of the arrival of the golden age of Pax, widely projected in Roman imperial ideology, right? Which we were just talking about.
Yep.
In that context, proclaiming the arrival of the new Exodus in Jesus counted as undermining the arrival of the golden age in Rome. Its illocutionary function then is not only to declare that the great day of liberation has arrived in Jesus, but by implication to convince the implied readers that it had not arrived by any other means. And this is where it starts to really do some deconstructive work potentially with the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
Roman Empire.
Yeah. And to be fair, so you did mention the Gentile God fear. So God, these are people who would not have maybe grown up hearing or reading Israel scriptures, but who may have become sympathetic. They become, you know, synagogue attendees and they begin learning the stories of Israel. And so they would have familiarity with that, but they would also have equal familiarity with the Roman imperial context. Now, granted, so would Jewish people in the Roman diaspora. Like it's not like they would have been isolated from ideas of Roman imperial ideology.
Right.
So we got to be careful of that traditional sort of dichotomy that's spelt out there. But what's important about it is this concept of convincing assumes then that maybe these particular implied readers will say may have been in some danger of thinking otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know this with certainty. We can't say this about empirical people.
Right.
This is why I lean in on the implied readers because sure, some empirical people in wherever city they're living in, it could be Ephesus or elsewhere, may have been inclined to that and some may not have. But the question is what is the text sort of assuming about what needs to happen with this audience? And so maybe the target we might say could be these people to whom might have some inclination to thinking otherwise. And so then the author's words here might be intending to actually challenge some of their ideology. Even if it's not something they currently believe, you may have anticipated that it could be a potential threat, to put it blatantly there, maybe the potential threat of them thinking that the effects of the Messiah are maybe not as great as the author intends to depict.
Or as the effects of the empire, right? So practically, because you were talking about how this maybe also potentially impacts us today. So maybe a way to try to understand what's happening in the context, right, with the implied readers and the speech act that seems to be happening here. If we kind of maybe back up from our context into that, it would be sort of like, okay, so today in the world, there are governments that are making claims that say that, look, we are going to bring about the good thing in the world, right? And so this would connect with the pinnacle of history. And there are different governments making that claim in different ways. If you're somebody from one of those places where your government is saying, hey, we're going to fix the world, or we're going to bring about righteousness or whatever good thing is being promised, and you think, yeah, you know, my government is going to do that. Even maybe if you don't want it to, but that's still the primary, you look at like what's going to shape the world and you think, yeah, my government's going to shape the world. Ephesians shows up and says, hold on, there's something else going on that is happening in a way that you may not be able to see, because actually Jesus is bringing a new freedom, a new blessing, a new reality for people who are part of his story, right? And how we get to be part of his story is kind of that wrestling that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
But it says, hold on, hold on, hold on. If you think that your government or some other government is going to rescue the world, you're missing what the gospel is about.
Yeah, or not even just a government, anything else, anything, right? And that this is where.
So, for example, your philosophy, right? So, like modernism or liberalism or
philanthropy, right? Philanthropy.
Yeah.
So you're we think the solution is let's just get as much money as we possibly can, and let's get all of us rich folks together and start giving to the right places, and then we'll heal the world, sort of idea.
Right, or science and technology and innovation, right? That we're going to get there ourselves. That the promise of those things is so great that we're going to get there. And the author of Ephesians seems to be saying, if that's where your faith is, you may be missing the fulfillment of this great movement of the Old Testament.
Yeah, and I want to be cautious, because I think if we go maybe too far with that, it could lead some to say, see, this is why acts of justice on earth are irrelevant. You're putting too much faith in the government doing just things, or this is why acts of philanthropy are irrelevant, right? No, don't bother with that, because this world's just going to burn to smithereens and Jesus is the one who saves us. Like, I would be very cautious of not taking that approach though either, because I think there can be little isn't the right word. There can be expressions of what Jesus has done that are, I think, that are little moments to remind us of the great arrival of the pinnacle of history that I don't think has completely and fully happened yet, that I don't think we need to diminish. While at the same time, I think there's a qualitatively different kind of arrival that can only happen in the Messiah, that no government, no person, no group of persons, no philosophy, et cetera, can possibly bring about. So it's trying to balance that, because I don't want to go, I have heard those who would lean in on Jesus being the fulfillment of the pinnacle of history, who then would diminish all other forms of human acts of kindness, social justice. And I would not go in that direction, environmental concern. But I think everything could be put in context a bit on, and it's when it starts to transcend these things as somehow the sole or singular hope that I think becomes maybe concerning for me in a Christian theological vantage point.
Mm-hmm. So then backing up into the first century or whenever this letter is from, this movement of this passage is potentially, on the one hand, very encouraging, but also potentially very disruptive, right, to its readers.
Yeah, it could be disruptive in light of the Roman imperial context. It could be disruptive in light of other contexts. I did mention that there are other plausible, eschatologies that are floating around other than Roman imperial ones, but this isn't just about what they believe. This is also about how they would posture themselves towards those scenarios. So how would that impact and change the way they relate to Roman imperial rule, the way they relate to the Artemis temple, the way they relate to these other ideologies? It becomes complicated.
Yeah.
And it's not just as simple as to say, all Christians, because Jesus is the one that did this, all Christians did sever ties with those. That I don't think that we can say that. What we can say is that it led to some complicated negotiating between their identities as Christians and followers of the Messiah and the other contexts that they lived in where these claims were being made, and that may well have conflicted with the claims that they were also being made about their Messiah. So I'm sympathetic, and I'm sympathetic when we see in the 21st century Christian people who wrestle with what their Christian identity means to how they engage various public and various cultural contexts. It's not just so simple to say it's black and white that Christians always sever ties here or whatnot. And so some of that we're seeing happening, I think in ways that are tough to negotiate. Mm.
This concludes our first conversation in the final series about Justin's dissertation concerning imperial critical readings of Ephesians. Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. Reed Peters is a recognized patron of the show. As always, you can join us at patreon.com/profsinrooms for more conversation and bonus content. We hope you can join us for coffee again next time.